The Guardian.
Hello, Ian Sample here. And before we get started with today's edition of Science Weekly, I'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show.
Very often innovation comes from deliberately looking again at old ideas which people had thought were ridiculous or just wrong. There is a sense in Silicon Valley, there's a sort of resentfulness of the past, there's a sort of wish to disrupt institutions like education just because they can.
Why do old ideas, which have been discarded for centuries, return to the cutting edge of science and technology? Stephen Paul's new book, Rethink, shows what we can learn by considering obsolete ideas from a new perspective, drawing on examples from military strategy and psychotherapy to chess and morphic resonance. Ideas given a second chance in this way include electric cars and the cavalry charge, but also panpsychism and even teleology. Stephen, some ideas take off from the start, some die a death and others are revived later on. Rethink focuses on the last of these, the revival of old ideas. What do you think we can learn from studying them?
One of the arguments in the book is that we are operating with a rather thin idea of innovation in modern culture. You know, we have this Silicon Valley ideology where we think innovation is always hip young geeks inventing something from nothing and disrupting existing industries. And when I started to look into some things that just interest me, I started off being interested in panpsychism already, which is the idea that all matter partakes in consciousness somehow, and that's why brains can be conscious. And then I discovered that, as you mentioned in the introduction, electric cars are more than a century old. There used to be electric taxis operating in London and Manhattan in the late 19th century. So I thought, is there a pattern here? And it turns out there is, and very often innovation comes from deliberately looking again at old ideas which people had thought were ridiculous or just wrong. One of the Nobel Prize winners last autumn, Tu Youyou, was a Chinese researcher who was told by the government in the 60s to go back to ancient Chinese traditional medicine texts to try and discover a new treatment for malaria. And thanks to a tip she discovered in this 4th century manuscript, she invented what is now the best global drug for malaria.
You cover a huge number of examples in the book. You've got warfare, chess, psychotherapy, cosmology and genetics in there, but plenty more. One of the other examples you put out in the book early on is CBT, this common talking therapy, which has parallels with Stoicism. How are those two similar?
Well, Stoicism, from Epictetus to Marcus Aurelius, its essential message is you can't change what happens to you, but you can change what you think about it. And if you change what you think about it, that changes how you feel, because cognition has an effect on the emotions. And the people who founded what became CBT actually read the Stoics and were inspired by them. And it, pretty much the same message is in CBT. You can't change what happens to you, but you can change what you think about it. And you can change how you think if you learn to take this kind of second-order awareness of thoughts passing through your mind and saying, well, is that thought useful to me? No, I'll try and break that rut, get out of that habit. So essentially, they're very similar philosophies.
And in Stoicism, they talk about taking this very high up sort of aerial view of things going on to sort of put things in perspective, I presume.
Yes, it's a lovely image. One of the Stoics says, just imagine watching yourself and everyone else from miles above in the sky, and everyone looks like ants. And of course, everybody's problems look very trivial from a cosmic perspective.
What also interested me was that there seems to be a revival in Stoicism itself, as well as it being maybe, you know, channeling into CBT. There seem to be conferences now being held around Stoicism and using that idea in life as a kind of, I don't know, maybe it replaces mindfulness, whatever the latest sort of well-being fad is.
Yeah, there is a real revival of Stoicism, because when you look into it, Stoicism has much more to it that's not really kind of happy, feel-good therapy speak. I mean, there are some things where they recommend you meditate on very bad things that might happen to you. Like, what happens if my wife is in a car crash, or what happens if somebody I love dies? And you meditate on those very carefully and in detail, and try to see them as what they call dispreferred indifference. Mm. So they'd be, you know, you'd rather they didn't happen, but nonetheless they would be indifferent in the sense that they wouldn't change your own moral integrity. And that's a very startling idea in the modern age. So people are looking back into the Stoics and finding these things which don't come in your normal sort of NHS CBT course and thinking, well, you know, these guys 2,500 years ago, they had it right all along.
Why were the Stoics like that? What did they see as a benefit from behaving that way or thinking in that kind of way? I mean, presumably they weren't trying to overcome these sort of tedious modern problems we all worry about these days.
No, but well, I think like a lot of ancient philosophy, the point of their philosophy was, you know, how does one become serene? Mm. Not necessarily happy, because happy has different connotations in the modern world, but how does one flourish and keep a serene, calm mind, because that they thought was the best state to aspire to.
Looking more generally over the sort of topics of the book, do you get a sense from going through and doing the research you've done why it is that some good ideas are effectively stillborn? We always say they're before their time, but that hides a lot of other factors.
Yeah, there are a few different reasons why. I mean, one could be that people just don't like the messenger. There's an example I go into, Grace Hopper, this great computer pioneer, who basically invented the idea of the computer compiler. So instead of programming in machine code, you could program in something that looked a bit more like English. And she met huge resistance for this in the 50s, because people who could program directly in machine code thought, well, I'm going to be out of a job if everyone can learn to program. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it didn't help that she was a woman, because the computer industry was even more sexist then than it still is now. Mm. So that idea, you know, it took about a decade to get established. And even then she had another really good idea, which was, okay, so you can program in words that look like English, if, then, go to, that kind of thing. Why couldn't you program in German if your first language was German? Or why couldn't you program in Russian? And she set up a demo to do this, and I think it was the late 50s or early 60s, when she was working at an American computer corporation, and the managers were aghast. They said, we can't have American computers being programmed in foreign languages. So that idea was completely shelved. And then just by chance, I happened to be having a drink with an interactive designer in London, and she said, she's from Uzbekistan, so her language is not English. And she said, yeah, I'm getting together a couple of my friends to create a compiler that you can program in different languages. And I said, oh, that's fascinating, because Hopper wanted to do that half a century ago, but maybe you can do it now.
Many things have to change before an idea that has been buried for various reasons can be resurrected. Are there sort of key common things that we can pull out and say, it's this type of thing that helps an idea that's kind of lost its way to give people a sense that it's justified to look at it again?
Yeah, one is simply changing social attitudes. Mm. People used to think the idea of eating insects, at least in the Western world, was disgusting, even though, you know, there's a man who published a pamphlet in the early 20th century called Why Not Eat Insects? And it had these recipes like moths on toast. Absolutely disgusting. Of course, it didn't fly because, you know, people had enough food in the UK and insects in Western Europe aren't very big, so you've got to collect a lot of them. So that idea didn't fly, even though, of course, people in other parts of the world have been eating insects for centuries and millennia. But now people are getting it back onto the agenda. They're making cricket flour and they're making snacks out of interest. And there was a UN conference on this a couple of years ago. And this is because, well, the situation has changed and we're worried about the increase in population so much and we're worried about the sustainability of agriculture. We're worried there might not be enough protein for the whole planet. And there's all this protein locked away in insects that people like us find disgusting. So they think, actually, maybe we should give this more consideration because, you know, we might have to.
So insects back on the menu for sure now, do you think? Do you think that's an idea that we can now say is floating?
Well, I mean, you've got to overcome the disgust reaction. And what people are doing are using sort of clever rhetorical devices to, you know, they're calling insects mini livestock. So it's like a cow or a pig, but just very small. And, you know, they're using different names to try and... But I think as long as we live in a land of plenty, I think it's going to be difficult to overcome people's disgust. But another reason, a different reason ideas can come back is that science progresses in a way such that it kind of destroys our old certainties. And this is one of the arguments that panpsychists make these days. You know, they say, well, people used to be certain that matter was basically like tiny billiard balls crashing into each other, and the whole universe was this clockwork mechanism. But then 20th century quantum physics comes along, and it turns out that matter is weirdly immaterial. It's charges or its points in fields, and it's really difficult to know what it is in itself. And so a panpsychist these days would say, so we actually have no evidence that consciousness is not part of matter because we don't really understand matter at all. Mm. We understand it less than we thought we did a couple of centuries ago.
Max Planck, one of the physicists involved with quantum theory back in the day, said that science progresses one funeral at a time, suggesting old ways of thinking had to sort of clear the stage before these new ideas could really bloom. But it sounds as if the sort of the old prejudices need to die as well, like that every generation is kind of burdened by the prejudices of the generation above. They've killed ideas that you can then go and resurrect without resistance, perhaps.
Yeah, and the same might be happening even of an idea like eugenics, which, of course, since the Second World War and before, has been associated with some of the worst horrors of the 20th century. You know, people are never going to forget about that. But that's an idea which I call a pariah idea because it's become associated with some particularly bad things in history. But those things aren't an inherent part of the idea, and there is now a group of philosophers and bioethicists who call themselves liberal eugenicists. They say, now we've got CRISPR and ways to edit the genome, and we already do some kind of eugenic practice in that we can fix genetic diseases in embryos before implanting them. What's wrong with improving humans, giving them better lives when they're born? What's inherently wrong with that if you take away the associations with Nazi euthanasia programs and American sterilization of what they considered the unfit?
That was the most controversial part of the original sort of eugenics movement, though, wasn't it? It was not so much the preservation of the good, but the sterilization of those deemed feeble-minded and those deemed undesirable by society, the negative pressure on them, rather than just the whole idea that we will lift everybody up.
Indeed, and modern thinkers separate these two things out. So they say that negative eugenics is, at the extreme, killing people you don't like or just not allowing them to breed. But positive eugenics does not put any pressure on other people. It just says, how can we improve things? How can we enhance the human race? You know, there are some people who think we need to genetically enhance human intelligence, if that's mechanistically possible. I mean, it's a difficult idea right now, but we need to, because otherwise we might destroy ourselves and, you know, blow up the planet somehow. So they think there are actually good moral reasons to take control of evolution now that we have some of the tools to do so and accelerate our evolution into a better class of being.
But Homo erectus lived for like 2 million years. It was the most successful human ever, and it wasn't as smart as us. I think intelligence is probably our downfall, isn't it? We don't want to be more intelligent. We'll make even more devastating weaponry.
Well, you might say that intelligence is a kind of neutral capacity, and it depends how you use it.
You could. We could use it for defending against asteroids. You raised Silicon Valley earlier, and talking about this idea, you know, we always hear, you know, every TED talk is another disruptive technology idea, what have you. Is Silicon Valley actually that disruptive? And if it is disruptive the way to go? Is that really the most efficient way to progress? Or should we be just getting better at mining the past for old ideas?
I mean, obviously, it's not a binary one or the other question, but I think the balance in sort of modern popular discourse could be shifted back. I mean, there is a sense in Silicon Valley, there's a sort of resentfulness of the past. There's a sort of wish to disrupt institutions like education just because they can. And they're not really thinking seriously about what's good about how those institutions have evolved over decades and centuries. So I think it's just a question of rebalancing rather than of avoiding trying to change things from the ground up or just going back to the past for everything. Because as I point out in the book, the idea that all good ideas had already been had in the past was what people thought before the scientific revolution in the 16th century. Pretty much everyone thought that Aristotle had been right about everything and there was nothing new to be discovered. And then someone invented a telescope and then everything else happened and it turns out there was a lot of new stuff to be discovered.
But in Silicon Valley, is there a sense that if something is disruptive, that in itself has merit? Or that, you know...
There is that sense. Yeah. You know, just disruption is a good thing. You've got to move fast and break things, which used to be Facebook's internal slogan. It's this idea, they've taken Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction, as that's what he calls it, to an extreme, whereby, just disrupting the taxi industry or the education industry or any old thing is in itself good. That's obviously not true.
How good are we at learning from the past, or at least mining old ideas that were before their time? Because I can imagine in the sciences, there may be loads of ideas kicking around in journals that people have thrown up, which have just been long forgotten because they've never really been cited that much. And someone at some point will rediscover them way after they've reinvented it themselves anyway.
Yeah, and I'm sure that happens a lot. And I talk in the book about this, the great scientist von Helmholtz in the 19th century said, you know, there are too many untried hypotheses being published in the scientific literature, even then, he said. And of course, some of them might be true, but just by chance, yeah, because they're not very well argued. And how do you sift the good from the bad? And I'm sure a lot of people think about things and then realise that someone else had that idea in the past. But when I was talking to the philosopher Galen Strawson, he made the excellent point that I said, well, don't you feel annoyed by that? You thought you'd had an original thought. He said, no, not at all. I find it moving, this connection across the centuries. And if some really clever guy like Locke 200 years ago had the same idea, that, you know, I find that encouraging. And I did speak to some scientists who deliberately looked to the past while they were doing their research. One of them was Isabelle Mansuy, who's done this research on epigenetics. And she did this extraordinary series of experiments which showed that if you make a rat really depressed by effectively being really nasty and sadistic to it, and then you have this rat mate with a completely healthy rat, the pup rat, the rat's child, will be born with a disposition to stress and depression. And this is the heresy of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which the late 18th century biologist Lamarck thought was going on in evolution before Darwin. And then for a century, people thought, no, this can't happen, because we know how inheritance works. It works through the genes. But Mansuy told me that while she was doing this research, she was reading old manuscripts of Lamarck and thinking, this guy was traduced by history. You know, he had a good idea, and nobody knew how it worked, but he was onto something, and she thought her experiments vindicated him.
Do you think they do? I mean, there's still an awful lot of controversy over whether you really do get sort of that kind of epigenetic inheritance in the way it's put forward, you know, certainly in things like mammals and humans. I mean, you may get it in some plants and things like that, but the idea that you're getting a change acquired through the environment passed down the generations is still pretty...
It's still very controversial, and there are a lot of geneticists who don't believe it at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, like many of the ideas that are coming back in my book, I'm trying not to assert their truth, but saying, isn't it interesting they're coming back? And there's a, you know, the research that Isabelle Mansuy has done is very, very suggestive. And it's not to say that, there are no other ways that genes can be switched on and off during an organism's life, because we already knew about transcription factors and things like that in the 60s. But there are Mansuy's experiments and a couple of others that do seem to imply, that suggest that there is some kind of inheritance going on like this, at least through the first couple of generations. Whether it has a longer-term evolutionary effect, of course, nobody knows yet, because they haven't been able to do those kind of long-term studies.
How do we get better at spotting good ideas that have been dismissed and lost? Is there a way we can kind of try and improve our hit rate so that it's not just a lottery?
Yeah, I suggest some ways in the book, and it kind of depends on what kind of idea it was in the first place. So Lamarck's idea that an animal could pass down acquired characteristics is something I call a black box idea. It's a really interesting idea, but nobody knows how it works. Nobody knows the mechanism. And in fact, one of the great evolutionary biologists of the early 20th century said, well, because we can't point at the mechanism, we should discard this idea. But it turns out that eventually you can open a black box and look inside it and find out how it does work. So if an idea has been dismissed because it's a black box, then it might be worth reviving. Another reason, if an idea has been dismissed because of the messenger at the time, like Grace Hopper couldn't get her idea through because she was a woman and her idea also threatened the power of computer programmers.
You've already mentioned panpsychism, and you delve into that idea in the book, which is making some kind of comeback. Just for those of us who don't know too much about panpsychism, what is it in a nutshell?
It's an approach to what's known as the mind-body problem. The mind-body problem is the fact, well, we seem to know that we live in a deterministic, mechanistic universe. Human beings are made of matter like anything else. The constituents of matter obey the laws of nature. And yet brains, human brains, have this first-person awareness, this conscious experience. And nobody knows, nobody has the faintest idea how the activity of the neurons in your brain leads to this special thing that we know of as consciousness awareness. And it's a huge problem that's been a problem for a long time. There's no good answer to it yet. So what the panpsychist says, and has said for more than two millennia, is, oh, well, it's simple. Everything is conscious. All matter is conscious to some degree. So it's not surprising that a brain would be conscious, because a pebble on the beach has a tiny glimmer of consciousness. It's not necessarily having full-blown thoughts or dreams, but it has some kind of awareness to it. So does an electron. Consciousness is just a fundamental property of a quark, like electric charge, like spin, like its other qualities.
So would that mean, though, that a mountain would be more conscious than me? There's more matter there.
There's more matter, but I think there. The panpsychist would say it's not very interestingly organized. So there's some sense in which the complexity of organization of matter increases the consciousness of the thing you're talking about. But this is an example of, you know, the notorious problem with panpsychism is what people call the combination problem. They say, okay, well, if you think a grain of sand is a little bit conscious, why isn't it the case that if you put lots of grains of sand together, you just have lots of little consciousness? Why is it the case that if you put all the neurons together in the brain, one single neuron must be very minimally conscious? So how come if you put billions of neurons together, they turn into this rich human experience that we all have? And so the critics would say, surely experiences don't sum that way. You know, you just have a collection of tiny consciousnesses. And the panpsychist would reply either, well, we know that we do have experience, so it must happen somehow. It's a black box idea. Mm. We don't know the mechanism, but it must be happening. Or a more intriguing line of argument is the panpsychist would say, well, what makes you think that there are lots of little things anyway?
Right.
Maybe there's only one big thing, and everything we see as separate plural objects is just the same big thing under a different aspect. And this is an old idea called monism, which Spinoza and Leibniz had. And, you know, the panpsychist could revive it and, say, again, appeal to quantum physics. It seems that at base, you know, a particle isn't a tiny billiard ball. It's a point-like excitation of a field. Mm. And fields are sort of pervasive through space. So, you know, the idea that there are separate objects, it seems to be broken down by modern physics as well. So maybe smallism isn't true. Maybe there's just one big thing and it's all conscious.
What's the driving force for the return of panpsychism, if it really is in a return?
The driving force seems to be that it's still the least bad answer to the question of how consciousness arises.
Is it better than consciousness emerging from having all these neurons connected and all this activity and the way the brain is put together?
Yeah, well, some people like the idea of emergence. And I put this to Galen Strawson, who's one of the foremost modern panpsychists. And he said, well, it depends whether you find this idea of emergence spooky. That's what he calls it. We know that liquidity emerges from, water molecules, but we can sort of predict how that happens because we can simulate how that would happen with the molecules all slipping over one another. But at the moment, we don't have the slightest idea how this emergence allegedly happens from the electrochemical activity into the brain because it emerges into a completely different sort of thing. So Strawson just says, okay, if you believe that can happen, then fine. That would be another black box idea because we don't know how it works. But he says, if you've got the feeling that that's just too hand-wavy, it's not a proper explanation, then you have to reject spooky emergence and say that the answer must be something different.
What does it mean for an electron to have experience?
It doesn't mean that the electron is like whistling a tune to itself and dreaming and occasionally reading Shakespeare. And of course, we can't ask an electron because it can't speak. But it's a sort of imagistic, sort of poetic idea. But I think the idea is there's a glimmer of something like awareness in the tiniest thing. And I think that's the most detailed description you're going to get.
In the end of the day, this has to come down to ultimately, presumably, and I'm aware I am presuming, something that would be measurable, a difference, a thing, like charge or something like that. It has to be encoded somehow, right?
Yeah, but it might be one of those things that's very hard to measure.
Because,
like I said, you can't ask an electron how it's feeling.
Yeah.
You can't measure the consciousness of a human being directly. You can look at, the brain waves. And, of course, an anesthesiologist in a hospital will have indicators on a screen saying, oh, okay, I believe this patient's unconscious now. You can start the operation. But those are sort of proxies. They're not direct measurements of conscious experience because conscious experience is this, mysterious immaterial thing that we don't understand in the context of the rest of the universe.
Mm. You deal with some other fairly controversial ideas, and one of them being Rupert Sheldrake's hypothesis on morphic resonance. Tell us about that and if that's really now being reconsidered.
Well, Sheldrake is reconsidering it, but I mean, his story is really interesting because it's an example of somebody going back to the past and reconsidering old ideas, not necessarily successfully. Sheldrake was, a proper plant biologist at Cambridge, and he started thinking, well, the mechanistic bottom-up explanations of biology can't explain things I'm interested in, like instincts, how homing pigeons work, the extraordinary patterns on butterflies' wings and so forth. So he went back to early 20th century vitalism. And of course, this was one of the most disruptible ideas in biology, or if not in the whole of science, the idea that a living thing has something special to it that you can't explain in a way that you'd explain a table or any other physical object. There's some vital force, so people thought, the vitalists said, that explains living things. And Sheldrake thought, well, then maybe they're onto something. And he decided, instead of talking about a vital force, he decided to talk about morphic resonance, the resonance of morphic fields. And he thinks morphic fields are these sort of immaterial fields of memory. He thinks nature operates according to memory rather than strict laws. And he went off and wrote this book called A New Science of Life, which was promptly denounced in Nature magazine. And he never got an academic job again. And since then, he's been this kind of maverick. He calls himself a feral scientist. Yeah. Nonetheless, what I think is interesting about that story is that Sheldrake has annoyed so many people and been sort of quite aggressively sidelined, even though he's still asking scientific questions. I mean, he's asking questions about how dogs find their way home when they on these fantastic journeys. And we don't know how that happens. And it turns out that a kind of, arguably, some people think, Sheldrake thought a kind of Lamarckism was possible to do with the inheritance of instinct. And there have been some other recent experiments that seem to suggest that mice can inherit a fear of the smell of a cherry-like chemical if their parents have been taught to fear it. Also, the idea of morphic resonance itself isn't mainstream, and it might just be rubbish, but it's true that within developmental biology, there are ideas that look very similar. There's something called a morphogenetic field, which is an idea that it's a field. What's it a field of? Is it a field of information? Is it a kind of platonic field, or is it just a way of describing something? But it's a field that biologists suggest tells a group of cells to develop into an arm or a leg while the fetus is developing. And on the face of it, that looks like a similar sort of idea, although it's not suggesting something immaterial. So basically, Sheldrake might well be wrong, but he's not being unscientific. He's making predictions and asking awkward questions and pointing out the limits of what we don't yet know. Mm. And that is very annoying to some people, but I think the aggressive reaction to him... He did a TED talk a couple of years ago, and there was this huge outcry by, very famous and good American evolutionary biologists, and people demanded that the TED Association take their talk down from the main website and thinking, this guy's a complete crank. And I just think that kind of defensive reaction in science is counterproductive for everybody, because there are still a lot of things we don't know. And rejecting ideas out of hand is as bad as credulously believing in any old nonsense.
Did the similar sort of thing happen to Thomas Nagel, the philosopher, when he started talking about teleology? What was the story there?
Yeah, Nagel is a very famous philosopher, and he published this book called Mind and Cosmos a couple of years ago. He also is worried about the mind-body problem, but his approach to it was to say, well, evolutionary theory is all very well, but it can't explain how consciousness arises, because that's a very special thing. So I'm going to say there must be some teleological laws. And this is an old idea from Aristotle. Teleology is the idea that things somehow know what they're going to be or aim towards a certain result. And people rejected that in the 16th century because they said, well, this implies that causation works backwards. This implies that objects and organisms can somehow see into the future and aim for the thing they want. Mm. And that can't be true because it's just all the operation of chance and mechanistic causes. And that idea worked very well for a long time. But Nagel says, well, that doesn't explain consciousness. So he thinks there must be some teleological laws operating in the universe as a whole that biases the development of the universe towards the production of conscious beings like us. Now, that in itself is not an unscientific idea, but it's very difficult to test. But he really annoyed biologists for some quite good reasons, because he basically says there's not enough time has passed for evolution to produce consciousness. I find it implausible. He's even slightly too kind about American creationists like Michael Baer, the intelligent design movement. And so that really annoyed biologists who tended to kind of line up and say, this is the worst book ever published, at least the worst science book of 2012. Mm. And so again, they sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater by saying, well, he's wrong about evolution, so the whole thing must be nonsense. But the whole thing isn't nonsense, and there still is a problem about consciousness. And there's a problem about, what people, as lots of physicists themselves say, there's a problem about what we consider laws of nature to be. Mm. What are these laws? particles. Who wrote them? How do particles know how to follow them? These are not settled questions. He kicked the hornet's nest of the defensive biology industry in America. But then, as I say in the book, there's a reason why those guys are defensive, and it's a very good reason. It's because of the intelligent design movement, which is a Trojan horse for reintroducing teaching creationism in schools. So the public biologists in America get very annoyed, and rightly so, whenever they think that kind of thing is coming back, and they've done a very good job of defending science against it since then. But occasionally I think they can overstep the mark and sideline really interesting things which aren't necessarily threatening to them.
It can be really hard to know whether even some of these ideas that are being kind of resurrected, it can be very hard to know whether they are still nonsense as they were when they were first proposed, or whether there is something in them that, you know, in the light of a new day can look interesting. But I'm wondering if there is a value in considering what seem like mad ideas in of itself, that there is just a value in doing that for the sort of fertility of thinking, if you like.
I think that's true, and some scientists and philosophers have always said that too. There's a lovely image by Malthus a couple of hundred years ago, and he said, some people might think that, you know, asking these questions about what the ultimate nature of reality is, how human consciousness arises, some people might think this is just a waste of time. But then he says, well, imagine if a supreme being one day just, like, gave us the science, just told us all the answers. This is how it works. This is why everything works the way it does. Malthus says, if that happened, then we'd all be like sitting around thinking, oh, right, so well, there's nothing new to discover. And, you know, there'd be no spur to thinking at all. So he says the lure of these very big questions is worth it because we can make a lot of progress on the way, even if we never answer the very big questions. And similarly, the modern physicist Frank Wilczek has quite cheekily, but I think quite interestingly, said, look, the idea that science is all about falsifiability, that's a bit dry, you know, that makes us discard a lot of really interesting ideas. And he says, you know, maybe it's important if an idea is truthifiable. So he's taking the coinage of truthiness from The Daily Show, and he's saying, look, a truthifiable idea is not necessarily true, but it spurs further thinking, it spurs further research, and you might get somewhere you never expected if you don't discard an idea immediately just because it's not falsifiable, but just see where it leads. What is its fertility? What more ideas is it going to provoke?
Is that how we end up with things like string theory?
Well, I'm not an expert on string theory. I believe that, you know, derives from some quite rigorous mathematics. But again, I mean, string theory and brain theory and multiverse stuff, all this, there's a big controversy now in science about whether falsifiability really is a good criterion in science, because you've got Sean Carroll, the American cosmologist, saying, well, the multiverse theories might not be falsifiable if we can never interact with another universe. We can't prove definitively or not whether it's there. But too bad. If that's the way things are, then you've got to live with it.
Yeah.
Whereas there are other physicists and mathematicians writing into Nature saying, no, this is terrible. This is a destruction of the foundations of science. If we abandon falsifiability, then anything goes, and you can say any old nonsense. So there's this big struggle happening between sort of sobriety and imagination, if you will, in the scientific culture.
I like the idea you bring into the book, which is slightly different, which is around zombie ideas. And I took from this the idea of it being ideas that are shambling around in our midst that really shouldn't be there. They really should have been the ones that sunk and without trace in history, but they're still with us today.
Yeah, I took this phrase zombie ideas from the economist John Quiggin, who wrote a brilliant book on zombie economics after the financial crash. And he said, look, the global financial crisis has proved that some statements in economics, like the efficient markets hypothesis, they're just false. Otherwise, this wouldn't have just happened. So it's a zombie idea. It should have died, but you can't kill it. It's still shambling around. It's amazing to discover in this day and age that there are increasing numbers of people who believe the world is flat. And you think, well, we've known the world isn't flat, not just for 500 years, but for thousands of years. We've known the world is round. And yet there are people on the internet, there are these very elaborate scenarios. The world is actually flat. You think Antarctica is the South Pole, but it's actually this wall of ice around the kind of disc world planet. And actually the whole flat Earth is covered by this impermeable dome. And what you think of the stars and the moon and the sun are just these holographic projections. It's this crazy theory, but quite a lot of people believe it. It's a massive zombie idea. But it also has this really interesting dynamic because it's provoking a lot of other people to create these wonderful little educational websites. Well, actually, this is how we know the world is round.
Yeah.
Here are the demonstrations they did in ancient Greece with measuring the shadows cast by sticks in different places. All these other things. And so it's this zombie idea is actually provoking a new educational spurt, which may, after all, be a good thing. So the ecology of ideas is very complicated, and it's not necessarily a bad thing that a terrible idea comes back if it can be refuted again, so more people understand the truth more directly. It raises these quite fundamental questions in epistemology and the sociology of knowledge, because the flat earthers say, well, how do you know the world is round? You know, you walk around on the earth and it seems flat to you. How do you know it's round? Because people tell you so, and you're believing in authority. So in a sense, they're just radical empiricists. They're saying, don't believe authority, believe your own experience. And they've got a point, because we all take almost everything on trust from authorities. Even people who have very specialized knowledge in literature or quantum physics, they take their knowledge of chemistry and politics and all kinds of other stuff, they take it on trust because there are experts telling us so. So the idea that the appeal to authority is always a fallacy is itself a fallacy. We couldn't live without having these authorities telling us what's the case. So they've got a point there. And they've also got a point that, you know, we don't know that the universe wasn't created 5 minutes ago, and we were created along with it, with all our supposed memories. So they have this conspirological idea, but it's actually quite hard to refute. So they raise these quite interesting questions in philosophy of knowledge and philosophy of science, probably without even meaning to. But it's an interesting dynamic again. So zombies can be fruitful if they lead you to those kind of questions.
Stephen, at the end of the book, you touch on this question of which old ideas are ripe to resurrect to improve the world today. What's on your mind there?
Well, one of them was, I talk about the way the free will debate has surprisingly been revived yet again. And this old question, you know, we seem to live in this mechanistic universe, but we think we can control our actions. We think we have a choice at any moment over what to do. But if our brains are just following the laws of physics, then surely we can't. Surely we're just going to do what we're going to do, and we have no freedom. This debate has been revived, and there are people arguing on both sides still, and there are all kinds of philosophical flavours of one or the other. I like Schopenhauer's idea. He's this very hilarious and rather nasty 19th century German philosopher. And he thought that a will to continue existing was something that drove all things. I want to do an argument a bit like the argument for panpsychism and say, well, what makes you think that will isn't a quality of an electron? So why can't we have pan-willism? Will is a fundamental property of all matter. So as human beings, we have free will, and you know, you've got no evidence to the contrary. So that's one suggestion. And another one, which isn't in the book, but which has come to my mind recently, is we might want to revive the idea of Europe as being a sort of harmonious place of scientific and cultural exchange, a force for peace and good in the world. But the way things are going, it looks like that idea might be consigned to a period of darkness.
Stephen Poole there. Rethink the Surprising History of New Ideas is published on 30th of June by Random House. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Stephen Poole. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.